Probably think, well, that's an interesting reading for Advent. That is actually the assigned reading that comes out of the lectionary schedule that we follow, and it's not actually out of place. Because when we come to Advent, there's two Advents that we're thinking about. Advent is this word for the coming of Jesus. And so, on one hand, we're stepping back and thinking about what it was like for the Jewish people waiting for the coming of Jesus, leading into that first Christmas. But we do that because we can learn a lot from them, at least from the scriptures that were meant to help them, and because we're in the same place, we are waiting for Jesus' second advent. Just as he came, he will come again. And so we understand what it is to have promises and to be waiting. And so a passage like we read there in Mark is a passage about Jesus' second advent, his return. And it reminds us of the waiting. It also reminds us we've been given some scriptures, some prophecies, some promises to hold on to as we wait and to look for him. So we're going to be doing a lot of that these coming weeks, is sort of going back and forth, Old Testament, New Testament, looking at what it was like to wait for Jesus in his first advent, to see how that teaches us to shape our faith as we await his second advent. And so I'm going to go to a different passage today. And let me open it this way. There's a t-shirt I've seen. I've had a couple of people threaten to buy it for me. And it says on it, "I can do all things through a verse taken out of context." It's referring, of course, to Philippians 3:14, which says, 4:13. That's 3:14. I just looked it up. Well, we'll check. I might have typoed. The 3 and the 4 swap. That's classic me. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." It's a good verse. And the t-shirt is a tongue-in-cheek joke that many people quote that verse without any sense or any idea of what it's talking about. That passage in Philippians, Paul's talking about how he is able to live in poverty or abundance. I can go with nothing, I can, you know, abound. He says, either is fine. He can do all things through Christ. And so it wasn't promising that Christ would help him get whatever he wants, but that Christ could sustain him even if he goes without. And yet, generally, when people quote that verse, they quote it because they're looking for success. They quote it as though it promises them that they're going to pass a test or get, you know, do great on a job interview, have victory over some issue they're struggling with. But in context, what the verse is saying is that through Christ, you can handle losing those things. Even if you fail the test, you can do all things. Christ can get you through that. Even if the job doesn't come, Christ can get you through that. So it's still a powerful verse. More powerful, I think, actually, than the way we normally talk about it. And the biblical hope is often like that. It's better than the shallow substitutes and catchphrases that we're tempted to settle for. And so today I want to look at another one of those type of verses that I think hits on a similar theme. It's quoted at nearly every graduation ceremony where a Christian gets to share a Bible verse. And it's a great passage for teaching us about the hope God gives. And I don't think it means what people quoting it think it means. And I've wanted to preach on this verse for a long time. We're going to look at Jeremiah 29:11. Some of you might know it just off the top of your head. It says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." Again, it's a great verse. You may want to just, if you don't have your Bibles open to Jeremiah 29, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but I'm going to summarize the flow of the passage to show you where does this promise come from? What's going on with Jeremiah that he shares this word? Who's he talking to? Where are they at? Why do they need to know it? Just like the verse in Philippians, the true story of Jeremiah 29:11 is found in its context. Jeremiah 29, the chapter, opens with a letter to the prophets and the Israelites who had been taken from Jerusalem and carried into exile in Babylon. That's verse 1. These are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders of the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. That's the opener. It's a context of failure, of disappointment, of judgment. They've already lost. You know, when you hear that, I know the plans I have for you, you think optimistically about the future. They're already looking discouraged at the past. The fight's already over. We're already locked up. We've already been carried away. And so then in verses 1 through 7, it tells these discouraged people an interesting thing. He tells them to build houses, plant gardens, and get married. And then it says, have your kids get married too. It says, try to keep your numbers up and bless the city that you're in. What he's basically saying is, hey, all you people who just lost, it's going to be a while. Get comfy where you are. You're not coming back soon. And so verse 8 through 28, literally both sides of the verse that we're looking at, deal with the fact that there have been false prophets who are telling Israel a different story. They seem to be saying, ignore Jeremiah and believe that God will return them soon into the land. In fact, verses 24 through 28 even relates how there's this one prophet who writes a letter to the priests in Jerusalem telling them to lock up Jeremiah, put him in stocks and a shackle around his neck so he'll stop prophesying. And he says it's explicitly because Jeremiah is telling people to marry and plant gardens and expect that it's going to be a while. Jeremiah pronounces harsh judgment from God on those prophets who are speaking falsely. He says they'll be judged for telling Israel these positive sounding messages in God's name when that's not what God is doing. The broader context, we got two references that sound very similar, Jeremiah 11:14 and Jeremiah 14:11. Both God had said through Jeremiah explicitly, he commands them not to pray against this exile. Don't pray that you'll get to stay in the land. Don't pray against Nebuchadnezzar. I have ordained this to happen. I won't listen to you if you pray that way. He won't listen. This was God's plan, and it was going to happen. So that's what Jeremiah is making very, very clear. So when Jeremiah says in verse 11 that God knows the plans he has for them, it includes all of that. It includes Babylon, exile, the death of their king, the judgment of their prophets. And it's a big deal then that verses 12 and 13, right after this promise, say that they will call on God and he will listen. Verse 13 powerfully says to these discouraged, conquered people that if they seek God, they will find him if they seek him with all their heart. So what I want you to see is that Jeremiah 29:11 isn't written to dreamy high school graduates chasing after their best life. It was written to those who have stumbled and fallen. It was written to people who were already seeing God's plans unfold, and those plans don't look good. They don't look like they're plans for their welfare. They don't look like plans that will give them a hopeful future. That's why God needs to tell them that these plans are good. That's why God has to say, I know that's not what it looks like, so let me tell you what it actually is. God is giving them a basis for hope when everything else looks hopeless. And if we're really going to be honest with our high school and college graduates, I would still share this verse with them. Because this is a better hope. Not that life will be great and blessings will come easy, but that even when the road is long and the loss is great, even then, God is still good. Our hope has not failed. He works through all that and still accomplishes His good purposes. The promise of God is the bedrock of hope. And so I want us today to look at a true hope. And this will be my one-line takeaway for you. What do we need to hear from this story unfolding in Jeremiah 29? Resilient hope comes from putting our faith in God's promise, person, and power. Resilient hope comes from putting our faith in God's promise, person, and power. So just looking at what I've sketched for you, the chapter 29 and this verse 11 that speaks hope. What do we learn about hope? Well, the first thing I hope you've heard is this tension between the false prophets and the true prophet is that for hope to be powerful, it must be true. You know, those prophets were just saying what Israel wanted to hear. You've been militarily conquered by a foreign nation. You've been ripped out of your homes and forced to march to the foreign capital of Babylon. This is a season of grief. And when people are grieving, sometimes we just want to say nice things to them, even though we know they're not true. Right? That's a temptation. You just say whatever nice thing comes to your mind because you just want to make the bad feelings go away. I get why these prophets are like, Israel, don't worry. God will bring us back soon. That's a great message. Way better than Jeremiah saying, plant gardens and water them because you'll be here for the harvest. Make sure your kids get married because your grandkids are the ones going back. You know, and so the temptation, you know, and we justify it. We say, well, I'm just sharing little white lies because I want to make people feel good. Most of the time when we face people in situations of crisis and loss and calamity, we're tempted to be more like the false prophets of this passage than like Jeremiah. But there's no hope in lies. When you make promises that aren't God's promises, you just let them down. Making God say whatever we want only makes God look fake. There's no comfort in that. When I'm suffering, when I'm in the face of loss, I don't need a fake God who doesn't show up, who makes promises he doesn't keep. That doesn't help me. Maybe you made me feel good for 5 seconds when you said the nice thing, but then I come crashing down on another disappointment when I'm already in a season of need. It just leads us not to hope in him. Why hope in someone who never comes through? That's what we make it look like when we promise what isn't promised. That comforts no one. The good news in our passage is that God does save his people in the way that he said he would. In chapter 70, Jeremiah, or chapter 29, Jeremiah explicitly says, in the 70th year, God will revisit his people. And he does. Yeah, that's not the generation that left. Their kids have to get married and have kids. 70 years is a long time. But at that point, God begins to turn the hearts of foreign kings towards Jerusalem and allow people to go back and begin rebuilding the temple. And over the next several hundred years, king after king will turn, and some of them even fund the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls, send armed guards to protect the Israelites as they rebuild their home. God was faithful. The promise that God did make, he kept miraculously. And so, while in Jeremiah's day it looked like it was the end of the Israelite nation, God would keep his promise. And even as we come to Christmas, we remember that Jesus is born in Bethlehem to Jewish people who were living back in the land. That only happens because the promises of Jeremiah came true. When you hope in what God has promised, you see the absolute faithfulness of God. When you trust in happy thoughts, you get a small fake God that can't stand up to the slightest storm. I've seen this in my own walk, in my own ministry, 100 times. So the reason we need true hopes is our expectations get set on the promises we receive. And our expectations can be the difference between joy and sorrow. One of the things I've loved to do in my ministry is I've taken youth on mission trips to England and Scotland. And we've gone to Scotland several times. And I've even have now dear Scottish friends who have come and visited here. They were here not that long ago. And it's funny because when they come here and they visit our gatherings, they'll often look at our gatherings with so much joy and gratitude. And their joy has a reorienting effect on me. Because we come with our expectations shaped by the fact that not that long ago, America was dominantly a Christian culture. So you could expect large churches in every town because everybody was going to go somewhere. Lots of Christian friends to pick from and Christian events to attend. So that's where our expectations come from. They come from a place where Christianity has gotten really small. And good gatherings and events generally require long drives, and they only ever happen once in a while. They talk about having a Christian conference they like to go to, and they drive long distance once a year if it happens. So we gather in our little churches of 35 or so people, and we think, where's everybody gone? And they come to the same gathering and say, wow, look at how many people came together. If our hope for church are captive to our culture or just random assumptions that we have put in God's mouth, we're going to be disappointed a lot. And this isn't about, you know, picking the Scottish versus the American church dreams. I'm not saying that they're always right either. We need to ask, what has God promised to this church? What has God promised to His church in His Word? We need to tune our expectations and hopes to that. Because when we anchor it to what God has promises, we anchor it to the joy and the hope of a faithful God who fulfills His promises. When we just make up random expectations for our churches and our gatherings, we shouldn't be surprised that our hope seems to fail and our expectations lead to frustration. If we don't tune our hearts to the promises of God, we'll instead replace them with other things. False disappointments will breed and produce hurt, and hurt will choke out our hope. And so for us, we need to be asking, what has God promised to His church? When you're feeling disappointment creep in, make sure you aren't clinging to things that He never said He'd do. When you're struggling to hope, ask two questions. Why am I discouraged? What's the basis of it? And what has God said? I mean, even over I can just look back to this past month. I had some things that were weighing me down. When I sat down in prayer and said, why is this bothering me? All the reasons were just my own things. Stuff I was hoping for, I wanted to make. I didn't get my way, and so I was bummed. And as soon as that hit me in prayer, I'm going, I don't even have a basis to be this discouraged. It was frustrating because I wanted to be mad longer and I knew I was going to lose. Because if I let my heart shift over to the promises of God, I have to confess He's been good. Put your hope in what is true. For hope to be powerful, it must be true. The second thing from this Jeremiah promise, I know the plans I have for you, is that hope expects trial. Right? Jeremiah is saying good news to these people. God will be faithful. God will do it. But you're staying in Babylon for a while. You will be subjugated. You will be defeated. Your prophets who are still making noise, they're going to get quieted. The whole passage is either Jeremiah explaining that the road ahead is going to be long, or he's denouncing those who want to act like he shouldn't say that. I want to encourage you. You don't need to be superstitious and worry that if you say something honest about the stuff we're going to have to face and wrestle with, that you somehow jinx it. Like we talk that way in church. Like, well, if you say the bad thing, now we have to have it. God was like, I don't know the plans I have for you. That was a terrible idea. Let's do that one. That's not our God. It's not like God was going to let them come back into the land in a week, but then someone had to doubt it, and now they'll have to wait a generation. Jeremiah calls those who deny the trials dishonest. They're lying prophets. And Jeremiah still says that God is giving the people a promise to hope in. This is consistent with how God leads his people across the scriptures. You can jump in anywhere. I'll take one well-known passage, 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. Did you hear that? That's an honest assessment of the Christian walk. And it doesn't say, God doesn't say, don't worry, come to me, you won't be tempted. That would be easier. Nor does he say, you'll be tempted in ways you can handle all by yourself. You got this. Pep talk. No, he says that he is adequate for the temptations we face and that he will provide a way of escape. The reason we can bear it is because of God's faithfulness. That's what Jeremiah is saying. Yes, this is going to be a long and terrible road. Many of you will die far from the promised land. But God is faithful. God has not given up. He will provide a return. God can sustain you in your land of suffering so that you don't die out as a people, but instead become a blessing even to the land you're in. False hope says, sit at the bus stop until God brings me home. Honest hope says, buy a house, plant a garden. God will water you where you are until he takes you home. See, shallow hope is often a guise for our unwillingness to suffer for Christ's sake. We like to dress it up with faith-sounding, powerful promises, but the truth is we're lazy. True faith will be seen in the Jewish people who retain their faith in the midst of a pagan land for hundreds of years. That's faith. Most of us don't want to do that. We don't want hard work. We don't want to endure. So we dress up our laziness as faith, saying, I believe that God will take us out of this trial right now. Amen. Our hope isn't that we will be spared trials. It's that God constantly, all through the biblical story, carries his people through the trials, through the flood, through the exile, through the persecution. Jesus went through death, not around it. Here's a hope that can carry you when whatever you are facing. That trial is not outside of God's plan. His good plan goes through it. And so we don't need to get discouraged because things have got rough, thinking we've lost our way. God leads his people through. The older I get, the more ministry I've done, the more this is something I'm passionate about. God is so good, and he has been so faithful. So many storms have come against the ministries I've served in. He has not spared me hardship and sorrow. I've sat in some bitter funerals. But he has used them to make me holy. And he has always carried me through. So now when it gets heavy, and I see life stuff coming on hard, and when I see that happening in the lives of those that I'm encouraging, I honestly get a little bit excited. When trials come, that's when you really get to see God's faithfulness. So hang in there. Don't jump out too soon. It's in the exile that they'll see God turn the heart of a pagan king to confess the reality of the God of heaven and the God of Israel. Some of the most beautiful things showed up right in the middle of the hard stuff. So don't jump out too soon. The trial isn't an obstacle to hope. It's where hope gets honest and real. It's when the shallow, cliche hopes of Christian t-shirts get burnt off and you learn how to anchor your soul to God. You know, so we find ourselves going, why does my family have to go through this? Why does my church have to go through this? Why do we have to wrestle with this or that? No. Of course we go through trial. We expected that. Skip the pity party and look for how to walk with God through the trial. This gets really practical. Trials produce perseverance when we endure them with faith in the right hope. The hope in the future, Jeremiah 29:11, isn't for all the Jews that go back to Babylon. Jeremiah prophesies that the false prophet, later in this chapter, is going to die childless. No future for that guy. Expect trials. And expect that God wants you to go through them, not to skip them or to quit them. So when the trial hits, we are usually thinking about how to get out of it or how to make it stop. Those are, I think, natural thought processes. But it's the wrong question. Here's the question that you ought to ask based on our passage. What does faithfulness look like in this trial? What does faithfulness look like in this trial? The trials are in the plan. Are you still committed to God's plan? God is going to be true to who He is in the midst of it all. And so whether that gives me hope really comes down to whether I'm willing to be aligned with Him in the trial, or I'm just going to ditch Him to get out of the trial. See, judging the prophets that were speaking falsely is still God being a faithful God. He remains good and faithful in the trial. It's just a question of which side of that faithfulness you want to be on. You want to join the prophets and see His faithfulness in judgment? Or do you want to trust Him and see His faithfulness in persevering and protecting? Last shorter point, and I'll wrap with this. The object of our hope is God. The object of our hope is God. I was tempted to say the object of our hope is God's promises, because in a sense it is, and our Jeremiah here is giving a promise to Israel. I know the plans I have for you, and they're good plans for your welfare, to give you a hope and a future. I'll bring you back. I'll bless you while you're in the far-off land. Those are promises that give hope. But underneath those promises is the one making those promises. A promise is only good as the one making the promise. When I don't believe God's promises, I don't believe God. This is what Hebrews 11:6 talks about. When it talks about faith and saying that faith has to believe that God exists, and that God is the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. That there's an expectation on who God is, not just that God is. Belief in a vague God just won't do in the midst of trial. I need a good God. When life is bad, I need to know God is good. Trials are a crisis of faith for the person who doesn't trust God's character. They'll say, I know He says He'll get me through, and I know He says He works all things for good for those that love Him. I just don't know if He actually will. That's not doubting His promises. That's doubting His character. Does God lie? Is God powerful? Is God faithful? So the question underneath so many of the other questions that we struggle with in trial is simply this: do I trust Him? That has been, in my own walk with God, the central struggle. I have all these things I think I'm wrestling with. Whenever I get to the bottom of it, it always comes back to just, do I trust Him? And the reason I'm struggling is because, no, I wasn't. I remember vividly, I've shared this story with some of you guys before, but I came down to the end of high school. My original plans for my life was not to be a pastor. I wanted to be an entomologist. I was going to study biology and study bugs. I hope to wind up being a field extension agent and help you manage your fields. And I have books, I had bug collections pinned, and I was already emailing college professors in biology departments to sort of scout out where I was going next. And then my junior into senior year of high school, I went out on a mission trip and got a little bit crazy and accidentally started a ministry, and got to the end of high school in ministry and trying to figure out, now what do I do? You know, do I just go, well, that was weird, drop it and go back to plan A? Or do I let God reroute me? But the ministry was, as you've seen them, this weird mime team. That's not a normal road, even for ministry. And I was just wrestling with what to do and whether I was even, you know, could God really change my plans and reroute my life? And so I said, well, I'm just going to take some time to pray. I'm going to set aside a little prayer retreat to go seek God's face on this thing. And I remember going out there saying, Lord, you know, I'll trust you with whatever you want to do, but you got to tell me what is the actual plan, because like we are so far off script. And you tell me what it is, and I'll make peace with it. You tell me what you want to do with my life. You tell me where you're going to take me. And I just got out there, and I remember sitting. It was Camp Conquest, nearby campground. I went up, and they had a little amphitheater area with a cross, and I was just sitting there praying. As I'm looking up at the cross, and I'm going, God, why don't you just tell me what you're doing? Tell me what you want to do. It was like I almost just heard the words, but do you trust me? Why do I got to know the whole plan? Because I don't trust him. I want to make sure it's a good plan. A little bit worried he's about to screw up my life. You know, the good track is go straight to college. If I deviate from that, we're off the good plan. And what if, you know, what if I get 5 years down the road on this thing and God didn't have a good plan for me and I want to go back to the old one? The reason God needed to tell me everything was because I didn't trust him. My issue wasn't the promises of God, it was I didn't trust him. I remember sitting there with the cross in front of me and going, what basis do I have to not trust him? Letting God make me a mime minister, which I thought was an embarrassing title, instead of a biologist, was the struggle. Did I trust him in what he wanted to do? Sitting at that cross, I saw everything I needed to know I can trust him. And we're going to take communion in a moment. Jesus' command was that when we do that, he said, do this in remembrance of me. Of me. Remember who I am. He was willing to suffer the agonies and torture of death for me. He was powerful enough to overcome sin, hell, and the grave. I can trust him. I can trust him. When you find that your hope is faltering, turn your eyes back to Jesus. Look to the cross. Remember who your faith is in and seek him with all your heart. Because if you seek him, you will find him. That's his good plan for you. And so even as we come this beautiful moment where we're going to remember the cross as we remember the manger, we just see pictures of God's faithfulness. This is the God you're trusting. This is the God who can give you hope. If you'll trust him through what he's going to lead you in. A true hope, resilient hope, comes from putting our faith in God's promise, person, and power. It's trusting in a faithful God to carry us through the trials by his providence according to his word. Advent is the greatest reminder that God has kept his word. He came to us just as he always said he would. He will come again. And while we wait, he has left us with a resilient hope to carry us through. Amen.